For those of you that don't know me yet, my name is Bill Haslam, and I am the pastor for student ministries here at CPC, which means that I spend more of my time downstairs with our students than I do up here with all of you. But I am privileged to get to share the message with us this weekend. And as most of you know, this summer, those of us who are sharing the messages were given the privilege of choosing one of our favorite stories from the Bible to share. And I have always loved John's gospel. In fact, that book of the Bible has probably been more formative in my growth and formation of my faith than any other part of scriptures. And so I get to share a story from John that has always resonated with my heart. This story that we're going to look at is in John chapter 9. So if you have a Bible with you, grab that and open to John 9. If you have an app on your phone, now it's okay to pull your phone out. We understand that's actually for the scriptures. We also have most of these verses in the back of your notes if you want to follow along there as well. This story that we're going to look at is about something miraculous that Jesus did during his ministry. But before we dive into the story, I want to acknowledge at the outset that the accounts of Jesus' miracles present a challenge for us. For some of us, those are the parts of the Bible that we'd rather skip over. Those are the parts that make some of us intellectually uncomfortable, because those are the parts that are simply hardest to accept as factual. The reason they're called miracles is because they don't fit our understanding of how the physical universe works. They don't fit our experience of everyday life. They don't fit our understanding of biology or chemistry or physics. And they're the things that Jesus did that he simply shouldn't have been able to do. So it's hard to accept that he was actually able to do them. So for some of us, it would actually be much easier just to focus on the love that Jesus demonstrated, the life that he modeled for us, and then just set aside the supernatural aspects of the story. And I want you to know, as someone who has a deep appreciation for science, that I totally understand that perspective. It is difficult to embrace as historical events things that really have no known rational explanation. But the challenge we face with the whole story of Jesus in the larger sense is that none of the miracles that he did are really any harder to accept than who Jesus claimed to be. The eternal, almighty Son of God incarnate in human form. In fact, the miracles of Jesus and the identity of Jesus actually go hand in hand. The reason Jesus referred to his miracles as signs is because they were meant to point us to his true identity. The supernatural things he did were meant to reveal his supernatural identity. That's what makes the miracles so important. So we really can't separate Jesus from his miracles. And this story that we're going to read about today is actually a story that captures that difficulty of accepting something miraculous that Jesus did and that tension that it creates. So whether you are comfortable or skeptical with the idea of miracles, I want to invite you to simply try to be open to what God might want to say to you through this story. And of all the miracles that Jesus did, the ones I love most are the healings. All of his miracles showed us the power and the authority that Jesus brought into our world, but the healing miracles showed us the heart behind that power and that authority. There's something so personal and so compassionate about every instance of Jesus' healings, and this story is the perfect example of that. In fact, I'll tell you, the reason this is one of my favorite stories in the Bible is because in the most personal way, it lifts a young man from the shadows and the sidelines of being just a helpless, disabled beggar to someone in the very center of God's story. Someone personally touched and transformed by God's Son. Someone who takes a stand for Jesus, and then someone who embraces Jesus personally as his Lord. So let's take a look at John chapter 9. This story starts with a question that I think we might still be asking today. John chapter 9, verse 1. As he went along, he saw a man blind from birth. His disciples asked him, "Rabbi, who sinned, this man or his parents, that he was born blind?" Now, it was normal, or at least common, in the culture of Jesus' day to assume that if something terrible happened to you or to a loved one, it was the hand of God bringing judgment against you for something you had done wrong. So when someone fell ill, or when the crops failed, or when tragedy struck, people assumed they must be guilty of some serious sin for God to cause them to suffer. So when Jesus and his disciples see a man who is blind from birth, the disciples asked him, "Who sinned?" In other words, who did something wrong to cause this man to be born blind? Did this man do something wrong? In other words, was he guilty of sin before he was born so that he deserved to be born blind? And yes, back then they actually believed that was possible. Or did his parents do something wrong so that they deserved to have a blind son? It's kind of a cruel question, isn't it? I don't think they meant it to be cruel. I think they were genuinely curious and wanted to understand what was going on from a spiritual perspective. Now, I don't think that we would ever ask that question out loud today if we met someone with a disease or some kind of a physical limitation. And yet, I do think we still wonder the same thing, maybe even if we don't realize it. I think we find ourselves asking questions like, "What did I do to deserve this? Why is my life like this? Is God angry at me? Is God punishing me or trying to teach me a lesson?" And I don't think anyone today is teaching that in our church or any other church around here, but I think we still fear that possibility. If things are going wrong in my life, is God causing it to go wrong? And is it because I deserve it? So Jesus' answer to this question is really important for us. Listen to what he says. "Neither this man nor his parents sinned," Jesus said, "but this happened so that the works of God might be displayed in him. As long as it is day, we must do the works of him who sent me. Night is coming when no one can work. While I am in the world, I am the light of the world." So in response to the question, who sinned, this man or his parents, Jesus said, neither. Now, Jesus isn't saying that this man or his parents were sinless. He's simply saying that this man's blindness was not some kind of judgment or punishment from God. In fact, he's saying just the opposite. Jesus says this man's struggle is actually an opportunity for the works of God to be displayed in him. It's important for us to know that. The struggles and the difficulties that we face in life do not mean that God is punishing us. Just reflect on that for a moment. Take a quick inventory of how you have been interpreting your own life circumstances. I know that you have faced some of your own difficult things in your life. In fact, many of us are in the midst of some very painful circumstances right now. Have you been assuming that what you're going through is God's doing because you deserve it? We live in a broken world. And yes, sin at the deepest level is at the root of that brokenness. But when God speaks to us in our struggles and suffering, he's not saying to us, "You deserve this." He's saying to us, "I know what you're facing, and I'm with you. I'm working even in the midst of this, and there is hope." Jesus said, "This happened so that the works of God might be displayed in him." Yes, we may make some bad decisions that bring suffering as a consequence, but rather than judgment and punishment, it's God's works of love and power and compassion that he intends to display in our struggles. And some of us just need to stop and take hold of that perspective right now. If that is you, please hear this. He loves you and he is working for you, not against you. And then Jesus restates something that he actually says in the previous chapter. I am the light of the world. When Jesus says, I'm the light of the world, he means that in the spiritual sense. He is the light of God's truth. But what he's about to do in this story is going to underscore that in a very physical sense. So let's continue where we left off in verse 6. After saying this, he spit on the ground, made some mud with the saliva, and put it on the man's eyes. Go, he told him, wash in the pool of Siloam. This word means sent. So the man went and washed and came home seeing. His neighbors and those who had formerly seen him begging asked, isn't this the same man who used to sit and beg? Some claimed that he was. Others said, no, he only looks like him. But he himself insisted, I am that man. How then were your eyes open? They asked. He replied, the man they called Jesus made some mud and put it on my eyes. He told me to go to Siloam and wash, so I went and washed, and then I could see. Where is this man? They asked him. I don't know, he said. So verse 6 tells us that Jesus spit on the ground, made some mud with the saliva, and put it on the man's eyes. Okay, that's weird. If we just pause for a moment and admit that the way that Jesus does this miracle is a little uncomfortable, and maybe I should be more clear, it makes me really uncomfortable. My friends know that I have a thing about spit, especially other people's spit. And I mean no disrespect to our Lord, I just have an issue with it. But it is helpful for me and for us to know that in Jesus' day, I don't think people had the same hang-up as I do with spit. In fact, there were actually some writings from back in that time that talked about the healing properties that people believed saliva had. So it probably was not so weird for this man or for those around him as it might have been for me if I had been in his shoes. But here's what's really important to think about. From plenty of the other miracles that he did, we know that Jesus didn't need to use spit or mud or anything. Just his word was enough to bring a miraculous healing. And yet, interestingly, Jesus never heals two people in exactly the same way. The way that he did each healing was absolutely unique. And that was to make it clear that the power wasn't in the method, it was in him. And to make it clear that he recognized that each person he encountered was completely unique as an individual. Now, there are a lot of possible ways that we might interpret his use of the mud. Perhaps putting mud on him and sending him to wash was meant to represent the spiritual cleansing of our baptism into the life that Jesus offers us. Or perhaps Jesus' use of dirt in making the mud was meant to remind us of the creation story, when God forms Adam from the dust of the ground. And here, Jesus is displaying the power of God as he symbolically recreates that part of this man that didn't develop properly at his birth. But maybe the imagery isn't as important as the function of the mud. And here's what I mean. I think one of the reasons for the mud was simply that Jesus didn't intend to simply give him his eyesight right then and there. Instead, he asked him to do something in response to what he was offering, something that would be a part of his experience of his healing. So Jesus sent him to walk through town to wash in a particular public pool, the Pool of Siloam. And that name, John points out for us, means sent. It's not clear whether the significance of that name is in connection to Jesus, who was sent from God, or in connection to this man himself who was being sent by Jesus. But what is clear is that in that moment, this man had to decide whether he trusted Jesus enough to do what he instructed. We don't know how far it was to this pool from where Jesus encountered him, but we knew it couldn't have been an easy walk for a blind man. So it would have required a willingness to trust Jesus before he received his sight. And it's interesting, too, that Jesus sets up this healing so that when this man does receive his sight, he isn't there face to face with Jesus. If Jesus' only intention was to give this man the ability to see with his eyes, he could have easily done that in a single moment. In fact, in Luke 18, we have an account of Jesus doing just that for someone else. But as we get into this story, it's clear that what Jesus really cared about was giving this man the ability to see him with the faith of his heart, not just with his eyes. So the man does what Jesus tells him to do. He goes, he washes in Siloam, and he came home seeing. Just try to imagine what that would have been like for him. Jesus was not restoring this man's ability to see. He was giving it to him for the very first time. Many of us just have no idea how much we take for granted with our eyesight, at least until it starts to fade. People who are blind from birth cannot imagine what the experience of sight really is. They cannot imagine what the experience of color is. They cannot imagine the sight of a sunset or another face. So just think of what it would have been like to receive the gift of sight for the very first time in the middle of your life. So as this man walked back from the pool, do you think he talked about what had just happened to him? Absolutely. But the initial response from everyone around him was complete disbelief. It was just too good to be true or too crazy to believe. So at first, this man's neighbors were disputing whether this was really even the same guy that they had known as the one sitting asking for donations, asking for help. And he sets that straight really quickly. But then he's about to get caught up in a much bigger dispute. At this point in Jesus' ministry, there's a huge debate over Jesus himself. The Pharisees, who were the religious leaders of Israel, had already rejected Jesus and were opposing him. In fact, if you were to flip back to the previous chapter, John wrote down a quote that captures their attitudes towards Jesus. These Jewish leaders said to Jesus, "Aren't we right in saying that you are a Samaritan and demon-possessed?" That's what they thought of Jesus. And then right before we turn into chapter 9, they were actually ready to kill Jesus because of something that he had said about himself. And now with this healing, they take offense at the day of the week on which Jesus performed this miracle. So let's pick it up in verse 13. They brought to the Pharisees the man who had been blind. Now the day on which Jesus had made the mud and opened the man's eyes was a Sabbath. Therefore the Pharisees also asked him how he had received his sight. "He put mud on my eyes," the man replied, "and I washed, and now I see." Some of the Pharisees said, "This man is not from God, for he does not keep the Sabbath." But others asked, "How can a sinner perform such signs?" So they were divided. The Sabbath was the day of rest that God set up for us at the end of each week. God was clear from the beginning in his commandments that he wanted us to set aside our work on the seventh day and make it a day to honor him. So why would Jesus, doing something so amazing and honoring to God, be a violation of that commandment? Well, it really wasn't, except in the minds of the Pharisees, and here's why. They had become so obsessed with their religious perfectionism that they had added hundreds of extra rules on top of God's commandments as their way of interpreting what God meant by his commandments. And in the process, they totally missed the point. They totally lost sight of God's heart for us behind the commandments that he gave us. So according to their many rules, making mud was one of the countless things considered to be work and a violation of the commandment to rest on the Sabbath. And they used this against Jesus. Now, I'm sure some of them were just so caught up in their system of religious rules that they were honestly just confused by what Jesus did. But it's also really clear that many of them were just looking for a reason to accuse Jesus. What they really didn't like about Jesus was that his ministry, his teaching, his very presence was upsetting their grip of religious control and authority over the people of Israel. So this man who had just been blessed in the most incredible way is about to get caught up in their animosity towards Jesus. But what I love in this next section is how this dispute pushes this young man to make his own decision about Jesus. and how he begins to take a stand for Jesus. So let's come back to verse 17. Then they turned again to the blind man. What have you to say about him? It was your eyes he opened. The man replied, he is a prophet. They still did not believe that he had been blind and had received his sight until they sent for the man's parents. Is this your son? They asked. Is this the one you say was born blind? How is it now that he can see? We know that he is our son, the parents answered. And we know that he was born blind, but how he can see now or who opened his eyes, we don't know. Ask him. He is of age. He will speak for himself. His parents said this because they were afraid of the Jewish leaders who already had decided that anyone who acknowledged that Jesus was the Messiah would be put out of the synagogue. That was why his parents said, he is of age. Ask him. And then here's where it gets really interesting, and this is in the back of your notes. A second time, they summoned the man who had been blind. Give glory to God by telling the truth, they said. We know this man is a sinner. He replied, whether he is a sinner or not, I don't know. One thing I do know, I was blind, but now I see. Then they asked him, what did he do to you? How did he open your eyes? He answered, I have told you already, and you did not listen. Why do you want to hear it again? Do you want to become his disciples too? A little sassy right there. Then they hurled insults at him and said, you are this fellow's disciples. We are disciples of Moses. We know that God spoke to Moses, but as for this fellow, we don't even know where he comes from. The man answered, now that is remarkable. You don't know where he comes from? Yet he opened my eyes. We know that God does not listen to sinners. He listens to the godly person who does his will. Nobody has ever heard of opening the eyes of a man born blind. If this man were not from God, he could do nothing. To this they replied, you were steeped in sin at birth. How dare you lecture us? And they threw him out. It's sad that something so undeniably good as giving sight to a blind man could trigger so much hostility. And it's sad that someone who was just the recipient of this miracle would get caught up in that hostility. But it's clear that the conflict wasn't really about the miracle. It was about Jesus. There's still just as much conflict about Jesus today. Some people say that all the religious conflict in our world is really just over differences of culture and practice and how we express our faith. And if that were so, then we could just loosen our grip on some of our traditions and practices and learn to get along better. But the real conflict is still over Jesus, and it always will be. There's always going to be disagreement about Jesus, and Jesus himself told us so. In fact, in Matthew 10:34, Jesus said, do not suppose that I have come to bring peace to the earth. I did not come to bring peace, but a sword. Now, he didn't mean a literal physical sword of violence. What he meant was the sword of division and conflict over him. And in the same chapter, Jesus told his disciples, you will be hated by everyone because of me. Chances are good that at some point you've found yourself caught up in that same conflict and dispute. If you are a follower of Jesus, you will. And maybe we're more subtle and more polite about it today, but the tension is just as real. This young man who had never met Jesus wasn't even prepared to engage the professional religious guys in this dispute. But there's one thing he said that was so simple and so brilliant, I think we should hold on to it. Look at verse 25. He replied, whether he is a sinner or not, I don't know. One thing I do know, I was blind, but now I see. He doesn't even know enough about Jesus to really defend who he is or what he's done, and he's honest about that. We could learn from that. We might all have better spiritual conversations with people that don't share our faith if we were just more honest about what we don't know. But what this guy does know, and what no one can argue away, is that Jesus did something amazing in his life, and he's honest about that too. There will always be disagreements over Jesus, and sometimes you and I will get caught up in that. Our goal isn't to argue about Jesus. We just need to share what we know. And the best thing that you can share about Jesus, the thing that no one can argue with, is what he's done for you. When we find ourselves in a dispute about faith, our job isn't to come up with the best arguments or to win the battle. Our job is just to be honest about the difference that Jesus has made in our lives. But in the end, the Pharisees threw him out. And when it says that they threw him out, it probably means they really threw him out, that he was kicked out of the synagogue, that he was no longer welcomed in their religious gatherings, that he would no longer be welcome to practice his faith publicly with his community. And that is exactly what his parents feared might happen. But then that's where Jesus steps back into this story, down at verse 35. Jesus heard that they had thrown him out. And when he found him, he said, "Do you believe in the Son of Man?" "Who is he, sir?" the man asked. "Tell me so that I may believe in him." Jesus said, "You have now seen him. In fact, he is the one speaking with you." And then the man said, "Lord, I believe." And he worshiped him. Jesus said, "For judgment I have come into this world, so that the blind will see, and those who see will become blind." Some of the Pharisees who were with him heard him say this and asked, "What? Are we blind too?" Jesus said, "If you were blind, you would not be guilty of sin. But now that you claim you can see, your guilt remains." In most of the cases, after Jesus heals someone, the story usually moves on from there. But here, it didn't. And I think this is why I love this story so much. Jesus came back. He's not done with this young man, so he comes back to find him. And it makes us ask why. If Jesus had done the one thing that this guy needed, if he had addressed the greatest struggle, the greatest need in this man's life, then why did Jesus come back? Because Jesus knew that what he needed most was not his eyesight. We all have things that we wish God would fix for us, don't we? If you could ask Jesus for a miracle right now, what would you ask from him? For some of us, that's a fun question to ponder, but for some of us, that's a very painful question to ponder, because the burdens and the struggles with us in this room right now are so heavy. Financial troubles, career problems, legal troubles, health concerns, physical pain, and broken relationships that look like they might never get put back together. And we just wish that we could be the one to receive the miracle. And we wait and we pray. And we have to remember that God is present and he is working even in the midst of the pain and the struggles. But we know that it won't all be set right and healed and resolved until the end. Ultimately, for all of us, our complete and final healing won't come until the next life. But the fact that Jesus came back to this young man after the healing means that to him, there was something that mattered more than the miracle, something more important than just dealing with his physical blindness. If Jesus were to show up today and fix what we thought was our biggest problem, our biggest obstacle, our biggest struggle, it wouldn't necessarily be what we needed most, because what we need most is him. Jesus could fix our biggest problems, but it wouldn't necessarily be what we really need most. What we need most is him. So after the healing, after the obvious need is met, Jesus comes back to address the deeper need. Jesus comes back to find this young man, not to offer healing, but to offer himself. Because Jesus' primary motive wasn't to use this man's blindness to display something about himself. He cared about this guy, and he came back to make it personal. He came back to invite this man into a relationship with him. "Do you believe in the Son of Man?" was Jesus' question. The Son of Man was the title that Jesus used for himself most often. He was the Son of God, but when he stepped into life with us, he became the Son of Man. It was also a title for the Messiah from the Old Testament. So Jesus is asking him, "Do you believe in the Messiah?" But he's also really asking him, do you believe in me? Who is he, sir? The man asked. Tell me so that I may believe in him. Jesus said, you have now seen him. In fact, he is the one speaking with you. And then the man said, Lord, I believe. And he worshiped him. That was the moment that mattered most to Jesus. What mattered most to Jesus wasn't giving this man the ability to see with his eyes, but the ability to recognize Jesus with his heart. That was the one thing the Pharisees weren't willing to receive. So those that were the religious experts, the ones who had spent most of their lives reading the scriptures that foretold that God would send his Messiah, couldn't recognize him when he was standing right in front of them. They were stubbornly blind to who Jesus was. But this man, who was blind his whole life, was able to recognize him. It's a crazy contrast. Jesus said, for judgment I have come into this world, so that the blind will see and those who see will become blind. Now we often say that seeing is believing. Those are the words of a skeptical perspective. And sadly, we live in a world now with so much false advertising and fake news that we should be skeptical. You can't even trust the online reviews that are meant to tell you whether that product you want to buy is as good as it claims to be. So it's wise for us to be skeptical. We need to see things for ourselves to know if something is true, to know if it really is going to live up to its claims. But sometimes, maybe seeing isn't enough. With this miracle, the Pharisees had living proof standing right in front of them, and they still weren't willing to believe. Ultimately, Jesus makes it clear that when it comes to faith, when it comes to knowing him, seeing is not necessarily believing. Instead, just the opposite. Believing is seeing. With Jesus, we really can't see who he is until we're willing to believe. It's our trust in Jesus, our willingness to place our confidence in him, that opens our eyes in the spiritual sense. And I know that we're not all there yet, but Jesus is working patiently with us to bring us to that faith that will let us see him for who he is. This story sits right in the middle of a lengthy dispute in John's gospel, that lengthy conflict over Jesus, right in the middle of ongoing arguments over who Jesus was and what he came to do. And those arguments continue today, but the most important argument about Jesus that you will ever engage is the one inside you. And he intends to do for us what he did for this man. Probably not with a physically miraculous healing, because very few of us will ever experience anything like that. But in his own unique and personal way, Jesus shows up in our lives, reveals himself to us, and stands before us with exactly the same question. Do you believe in me? It's not our eyes that will answer that question. It's our faith that will make sense of what he's been doing in our lives. It's our willingness to trust him that will let us see him for who he really is. On a personal level, I'll tell you that there is still a lot about Jesus that I don't totally understand. A lot I'm still learning. I have a lot of questions I hope to ask him someday. But I can tell you what I do know. Jesus is still showing up to meet us in a personal way. He's still coming back to find us. In my life, he used a lot of great people in the church where I grew up to help me to get to know him. And by the time I was a teenager, I didn't know a ton about him, but I knew he was real and I knew I could trust him. And since then, I've gotten to see more and more of him, and I've gotten to know him better and better. My eyes were opened to Jesus in the most unmiraculous way, slowly, over time, with the influence of just good, faithful people. And in that way, my story is not amazing or remarkable, but I will say that the ways that Jesus has pursued me and cared for me is just as personal and just as compassionate as the way that he did it for this young man in this story. And I get to keep seeing that happen around me. What I most love about my role as a youth pastor in our church is that I get to watch Jesus continue to step into the lives of our students, continue to reveal himself to our students in unique personal ways, and I get to see their lives changed as a result of that. Getting to watch that and to be a part of that is probably my greatest privilege in life. But what about you? How have you had your own encounter with Jesus? How has he made a difference in your life? How is he revealing himself to you and opening your eyes to see him? I believe that someday you and I will see Jesus with our eyes. But between now and then, our job in this life is to learn to recognize Jesus by faith before we see him with our eyes. And Jesus' ultimate question for each of us is just the same. Do you believe in me? Are you ready to answer that? Are you ready to respond to that question the way this young man did? I pray that you are, or I pray that you're getting closer. And let's take a moment to pray that together. Let's bow our heads.